My name is David Bailey. I lead a ministry called Erebon. And the way the word Erebon is used in the Old Testament is that it says it means a foretaste of things to come. And so the way it's used in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, is that it's a Greek word. This is like the Holy Spirit was given to the church as a foretaste of what heaven is to come. But here's the thing, in the world doesn't get the Holy Spirit. What the world gets is a foretaste of heaven is the church. And so what we do as a ministry is we really try to help ask the question, what does it look like to be a foretaste of the reconciling kingdom of God? And how do we become a foretaste of that? So it's important to define a couple of terms. For us, when we use the word reconciliation, we recognize that there's some people that have issues with the word reconciliation. If you have any sense of any understanding of basic racial social theory, the idea, just any kind of reconciliation, it means that both parties were together as whole together at one point, and then something was broken, and you're trying to bring the thing back together again. Well, if you know anything about American history, indigenous people, First Nations people, Africans were never equal with Europeans and those people who have been defined as white. And so when we talk about reconciliation, we're not talking about trying to reconcile that, because that was messed up from day one. At most, what you could do is have conciliation. And we agree with that. If that's what reconciliation means to you, we actually believe that the word conciliation is a better term. But for us, this narrative is a very Christian narrative. And so, you know, we're saying that we know that, the world is broken, but it didn't start off messed up. It started off in Genesis 1 where the world was whole and it was good and beautiful. And then in Genesis 3, the world was broken. So we use this word reconciliation as a theological term. That means that, like, both our relationship with God, with one another, and the ground, the earth has been broken since Genesis 3, and somehow Christ is reconciling all things. And so if you're a Christian, you don't need to wonder, like, is stuff messed up? You know the world is messed up. The question of is how, and how is Christ reconciling all things, and how is Christ inviting us to partner in? And so as a ministry, what we do is we, one, try to help people understand reconciliation as spiritual formation, to realize that this is something that God uses to change and transform us into the image and likeness of Christ. Two, we try to increase the cultural intelligence of folks to realize, like, you ever been overseas and you try to order something and you might be with somebody else that's not as familiar with being in a foreign country, and they try to order some food and they realize that the people are having a hard time getting the order, so what they start doing is they start talking louder and slower to understand. Well, you gotta realize you talking louder and slower in English is not gonna help you out when people are in a country that speaks a different language. Mm-hmm. Well, this happens with us when we go from one part of town to the next part of town, from one culture to another culture, from an oral culture to a literacy culture, from one education level to another education level. And so we have to increase our cultural intelligence to know how to navigate the world in different spaces. The third thing we do is realize that people have different, we have to understand a shared narrative. We gotta realize that, like, we can have the same set of events, but based off your demographics and your experiences, you could have a different experience of what happens. And sometimes we realize that, like, oh, I was there, or, you know, like, pick whatever period of time. Or even the phrase, make America great again, right? Mm-hmm. Like, depending on what period of time, like, for me, you know, they ask a question, like, hey, if you could go back in time in the time machine, what period of time you would go to? And my first question is, am I black or not? Because if I'm black, I'm like, now's the best time to be black. You know, and even still, it ain't super great, you know. But going back in time, depending on what your experience is and who you are in demographic, you're going to have a different kind of experience. And so we got to understand different shared narratives. But then we also have to really, up until this point, whether you understand reconciliation theologically, you increase your cultural intelligence, you understand different shared narratives. At this point, it's all theoretical. It doesn't mean anything until you start doing, you participate in cross-cultural collaborations. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You've got to engage in cross-cultural collaborations to take the theory out of practice. I love this when I'm talking to my friends in Portland, and you know, because, like, you know, I always pick on Portland because, you know, or Boston, or those places where like people are like super progressive and they can quote all this stuff and be super woke. But then when you ask, like, well, how many actually people of color do you actually know and are actually work with? Oh, we don't really do that. You know, and so it's really interesting, whether it's conservative or progressives, you know, there's this whole, like, racial hierarchy, white supremacy dynamic that's at play. It just looks different depending on what the context is, you know. And so cross-cultural collaboration, where actually got mutual parties coming together to work on something, is like a key to take something out of theory into practice. And the fifth element is you gotta engage in reconciling culture making. We are here today because of the culture that was made yesterday. So if we wanna see something different tomorrow, we have to create new culture today. And we just can't just keep on like just having conversations and talking. We actually feel like, what are we gonna make together? Are we gonna imagine something that's gonna be different? So that's what, as a ministry, we help organizations think through. And part of the reason why is because we, for the last almost 12 years, we've been doing that ourselves. We've been in a community of practice that's been trying to figure these pieces out. So I realized about 9 summers ago, I realized that we started this church. I'm in Richmond, Virginia. There was a group of people that were inspired by Dr. John Perkins, and another person was on InterVarsity staff and started talking about racial reconciliation, and he knew he grew up in a Christian like community in North Carolina, but he realized that that community was not only Christian but also racist, but they didn't really understand that they were also racist too. And so he started having a reckoning, and he's a white guy, moved to the city and really started engaging in reconciliation work and really started doing community development. So in his work of community development, tutoring kids, and so I started after school program, and there was another group of students from UVA that were inspired by Dr. John Perkins, started doing home ownership programs and mentoring. And long story short, within about a 3 to 4 year period of time, about 100 Christians like lived in this particular neighborhood. Majority of them white, majority white. The few minorities that they did have were Asian minorities that were like on the way to going to med school. And so, culturally speaking, very like kind of white assimilated Asian folks. They would represent themselves in that same way. And there weren't that many African Americans that were involved. And so my wife and I felt like God was calling us to get involved. And so we decided to move into the community. And at this time, Dr. Perkins came and said, hey, you should start a church. And we decided to figure out, all right, let's figure out how we'll do this. There was a lot of unity and mission when it came to like doing a mission and trying to help this community and these kids out. But then when it came to worship, we were like, oh man, and the only reason why we didn't split up over that was because it would be silly to split up over worship. So we had to like figure out what does, like, what are the values that we have? And we have to be more center set on Jesus instead of versus bounded set. Like, a lot of times when you start a church plant, you say, like, hey, this is our theology, this is our doctrine, this is our denomination. So, you know, if you're down with that, why don't you come and be part of my church? Well, we didn't do that at first. We engaged in mission. So then we had to say, all right, what are our values? And how do we engage in our values? And so from the very beginning, we said, hey, we're going to be a Jesus-centered church. We're going to try to figure our hand both because we're going to be committed both to diversity across ethnic, racial, economic lines, not ministry to, but with, you know, and engage and be a kind of community-based parish model church. All that was really great in paper, but I'm gonna tell you, it was hard. The first 3 years, it was a lot of failure, and we realized as leaders that we weren't engaged as leaders and trying to figure out how to do this ourselves. And so we were hurting a lot of people. Because guess what? If you tell people you're going to do something, people expect you to do it. Mm-hmm. But then, as leaders, if you don't, like, take on the work and learn yourself, then, you know, you're just basically making a lot of mistakes and being really irresponsible. We realized how we were being very, very irresponsible. And so then we kind of went on a journey. And you're talking, you're talking almost 10 years ago. And, you know, at the time, there wasn't a lot of, like, kind of practical, even like kind of biblically based it was like racial social theory, and I call it like kumbaya theology, right? Like, and it wasn't, so we really had to kind of piece some things together and try to figure out how to do this journey. The second dynamic we had was, I realized there's these natural leadership development pipelines for white men, mm-hmm. you know? And so, you know, there's just like, if you see a talented white man, you could be like, hey, you got, there's some older white dudes going to like, pull them aside and be like, man, you know what? Here's how you navigate the ropes. Generally, if you're a white woman, you know, if you know how to navigate in a white male space, there's some opportunity for you. Or the third, if you're a minority and know how to like assimilate in white spaces, there's a space for you. And I realized that we kind of naturally started those deals. It kind of took some of the InterVarsity practices and some of the like Presbyterian churches practices, and that's what we basically, those were the folks who were the leaders, and that's how we started to do our leadership development. So I'm like, how are we in a 95% black neighborhood and we got 95% white church? And so I realized, you know, kind of when you take, you look at it like from an anthropological standpoint as a cultural anthropologist, you're like, man, we got, this is like a systemic problem. This isn't anybody's intent. This is anybody's desires. So what we did was about 9 summers ago, I said, here are like 3 problems that we have. One is our worship practice, we're like borrowing stuff from like, hey, let's do this hymn, let's do this like Chris Tomlin tune, let's do Israel Houghton, let's do an old school black gospel thing. And we were just kind of trading for and kind of negotiating multicultural worship. And I realized that the issues that we had going on in our community, none of these songs actually dealt with the pastoral issues that were going on. The other thing is we were preaching something and then we end up singing like a Me and Jesus or Jesus My Boyfriend type of song. And that was kind of like inadequate. So then the third piece was we didn't have a leadership development pipeline to develop leaders, particularly leaders of color and women that were designed for them. It's a very different thing with like, hey, I want to invite you to this table that's not really designed for you. It's another thing if you design a table specifically for them. And so what we did was we said like, let's create this internship to raise up leaders of color that will be in our community, but you know, we're gonna be very generous with them. If they wanna stay, great, but we'll send them out. And we started that 9 summers ago. What they do, they study theology, justice, reconciliation, and instead of writing papers, what they do is they write worship songs, and that's what we end up singing in our congregation. And that's how we shape the theology of our congregation. So I just want to give you like a little bit of background. I'm gonna give like show you like a little 2.5 minute clip that is going to give you a little bit of a insight of to see what we're talking about. And this whole point of this workshop is talking about the 11 a.m. Hour. A lot of times we really try to address this like Dr. King quote, 11 a.m. is the most segregated hour. And so, oh, what we need to do is we need to come together and worship together. And this is kind of the metaphor oftentimes used. It's almost like we want to set a table, and there's a table that's like, oh man, like we're not being hospitable. So let's try to one invite some different diverse people to the table. Let's maybe offer some kimchi because right now we got casseroles, and like you know, we'll say, well, we're going to do catfish. We'll do some kimchi. You know what, maybe we got forks and knives. Maybe we do some chopsticks. Maybe we should provide some injera just in case somebody wants to like eat with that a different way. And that's one surface level of understanding of diversity. But I think the biggest thing that we got to really pay attention to is what's the actual structure of the table itself. See, a lot of the structures of the table itself were actually designed for white men by white men. And I'm not saying this in a way to like saying it's bad or ill intent or anything like that. I'm just saying it's just a thing.
Just what it is.
It's just what it is, you know? So it's kind of like when I design, like if I design a really nice relaxing day, if I'm designing it for myself, it's going to look very different than if I have my wife in mind over something that we got to do together. And so just realize the structure itself a lot of structures were designed with white males, and it's like, oh, we need to invite women and people of color to that table. The, you know, that might become 20, 30, you know, 50% diverse or whatever the case may be, but just realize the structure itself is designed with one particular structure. Now, you could do a table two, and that table two is going to be a table of collaboration. That table of collaboration is going to be a lot more diverse. It's going to look a lot different, right? The structure is going to be like the table size, you know, if most of the guys are 6 feet, and then you invite the women to the table, they might be 5 feet to 5'5", or something like that, you say, hey, we need to adjust the size of this thing. You know, some people might like long tables, other people might like oval tables or round tables, because all of these things are so culturally influenced, right? Mm-hmm. What you think is normal, what do you think is appropriate, and like, why do you do what you do? And so that collaboration table is going to look a lot different. The third table is also equally important table. That's a table for minorities by minorities. You know, and so there's a role and place for that. And I think the question that you want to ask yourself is realizing that table 1, 2, and 3, when you're a Christian, the question that you want to ask, whether it's a table for majority, by majority, a collaborative table, or a table for minority, by minorities. The question, if you're a Christian, is one, you know that all cultural artifacts are needed across the board. Mm-hmm. But the question you need is, like, what does it look like for us to be a reconciling community within this space? See, if you grew up in table 3, you're used to either being invited to a collaboration table or serving at table 1. Mm-hmm. If you're from table 1, you know, you don't even have to think about getting to another table. And then when you become awoke, you know, you might do a collaboration, but rarely do you go the extra step and serve at table 3. Mm. And I think when you have Christian ethos in this space, it's really, really key to understand kind of like how you need all three of these things. And so what I want to do is just kind of like lay a foundation of a little bit of like, how do we move beyond having this like surface label conversation to even kind of think a little bit more on the structure side? I'm going to show this kind of like promo video of the internship itself, and just so you kind of get a little bit of imagination what that's like. Mark Charles is going to introduce himself and then kind of talk about some of the like historical foundational reasons that that deals with some of our challenges. And then we're going to do Q&A. Okay.
The Urban Doxology Songwriting Internship is an intensive 8-week leadership development program that produces culturally intelligent leaders with a passion for reconciliation. While embedded in the historic neighborhood of Churchill in Richmond, Virginia, interns train theologically and practically to engage with people of diverse economic and cultural backgrounds through the gospel and church-based reconciliation. Instead of writing essays, they channel their academic and hands-on learning into congregational worship songs that help lay the foundation for churches credibly witnessing reconciliation for the kingdom of God. Participants leave equipped to tackle the complex problem of racial division, both inside and outside of the church.
So what we're doing is a really uphill battle. There's a reason why people don't do this.
We're like total opposites. They put us together to songwrite. And at first I was like, child, I don't know if this is gonna happen.
It's not just saying, okay, let's put them together in the same room and have them just compromise. And it's definitely not a compromise. It is a repentance. It's an asking for forgiveness, turning to one another, and truly being prepared to sacrifice your own desires and old habits for the sake of your brother and sister in Christ.
Race matters, ethnicity matters, culture matters, and context matters.
If his kingdom has really come here on earth as it is in heaven, our churches need to resemble that kingdom.
Some things are taught, some things are caught. So we do a hybrid of teaching and doing life so they can catch some things.
I feel a breakthrough, y'all feel a breakthrough?
It's good, we're on the right track.
This internship has been really
transformative in helping me find my own voice.
Equipping emerging leaders is an essential step in becoming a beacon of truth and reconciliation to a broken and divided world. Join us in this vital work. The Urban Doxology Songwriting Internship, raising leaders who transform, witness, and restore.
That was a little bit of a trailer, but we produced a documentary called 11 a.m. where we address some of these underlying issues, but then it's called Hope for America from a Segregated Hour, because what we're trying to do is give some imagination. So I'm going to turn it over to Mark. And
all right. Well, you got A. You got A.
Mark Charles, Yunusha. Sinbakate Dene Nishle, Doto Hiklini Bashachin. In the Navajo culture, when you introduce yourself, you always give your four clans. We're a matrilineal people, and our identities come from our mother's mother. So my mother's mother happens to be American of Dutch heritage, and so I say, translated, that means I'm from the Wooden Shoe people. My father's mother, my second clan, is Tohiglini, which is the waters that flow together. My third clan, my mother's father, is also Then my fourth clan, my father's father, is Totochitni. That's the Bitterwater clan. It's one of the original clans of our Navajo people. Before I go any further, I just want to acknowledge that we are on the land of the Peoria, the Odawa, and the Potawatomi. These were the nations that lived here, they farmed here, they hunted here, they fished here, they raised their families here, they buried their dead here. Their stories were from here. These were the people who were ethnically cleansed from these lands so that the state of Michigan, the city of Grand Rapids, could be built. It's important that we acknowledge the people whose land we're on. This helps us to conduct ourselves with a greater humility, to remember that there's stories of these lands that predate white settlement. And it's also important to remember that these lands were not discovered. You can't discover lands already inhabited. And so it's important to remember that these lands were inhabited long before Columbus got lost at sea. In the next 20 minutes, I want to talk about some of the historical foundation to why this statement, 11 a.m., 10 a.m., is the most segregated hour in our nation. And for some of you may know, maybe you don't know, I've been writing a book for the past 3.5-4 years. It's on the doctrine of discovery. My co-author is Sung Chan Ra. The title of our book is Unsettling Truth, The Ongoing Dehumanizing Legacy of the Doctrine of Discovery. And when we signed the contract with InterVarsity Press about 3.5 years ago to write this book, I thought the research was done. I just have to get it down on paper. Well, as I began getting it down on paper and I began investigating things a bit more deeply and changing some of the stories and adding some nuance to my work, I began to uncover a lot more depth of a problem than I even knew that we had 4 years ago. And if you heard me speak 4 years ago, you knew 4 years ago I had identified a pretty severe problem. Today it's just an overwhelming problem. And about a year ago, as we were finishing up our first draft of the book and about ready to submit it to our editors, I wanted to change one story. There was one story we had included to start the book that, as a Native Indigenous man, I told and heard the story one way, but everyone else who wasn't Native or Indigenous heard the story slightly differently. And while it made the point, it didn't make the perfect point, and so we wanted to change it. And I thought about changing it to the story of Constantine's vision at Melvane Bridge, where he sees this vision of a cross and is told to conquer underneath this cross. Now, I haven't gone to seminary, I haven't studied church history, I haven't read these old texts, but I knew I could find it online, and so I thought, I will go back and read the context of this vision, and I will add, I knew the story, I just wanted to add it in. So I found out the book, the story was written down by an author named Eusebius, who was the bishop of Caesarea, And as I began reading his writings and understanding the context of the thing, a whole nother level of the problem appeared. And while it appeared and overwhelmed me, it also helped explain a lot of what I observed. So who here, as a person of color, has ever had or been offered to have your feet washed? By a church, by a community, some group, they heard you speak, they came across some racial problem, and they found you, they plucked you out of the congregation and said, "We want you to come forward so we can wash your feet." This happens quite frequently, for those of you who aren't people of color. If I had a dollar for every time my feet were washed, probably be a bit more wealthy today. But it doesn't solve the problem.
No, it doesn't.
And 4 years ago, I was working with the Christian Reformed Church, and we had written a report on the doctrine of discovery and presented it to our synod. And in our report, we identified that our missions agency, which used to be called something about heathen missions, the Center of Heathen Missions, it had run a boarding school. We didn't discover this, we knew this, but we acknowledged in our report that the Christian Reformed Church ran a boarding school in the Southwest for Navajo and Zuni students for about 80 years. Mm-hmm. And in our report, we included testimony of boarding school survivors from our boarding school, as well as boarding school survivors from a BIA boarding school. Mm. And we sent them on to the Board of Trustees, this report. And the Board of Trustees pulled from our report mm-hmm. the story of our boarding school survivor mm-hmm. from Rehoboth. And they only sent the report publicly forward with only the BIA boarding school survivor. When Synod wrestled with this report, one of the first resolutions they passed was Article 7 that acknowledged the existing doctrine of discovery as a heresy, and we reject and condemn it. It helped shape Western culture, and it led to great injustices, which is not a bad article and was approved rather quickly. But if you watch the video online, and you can see it online, Synod immediately pivoted and went into a 20-minute period of sharing about how great their boarding school was. And then they passed a resolution that stated that Synod nevertheless recognized also the gospel motivation in response to the Great Commission, as well as the love and grace extended over many years by missionaries sent out by the CRCNA to the indigenous people of Canada and the United States, and we give God thanks and honor for their dedication. Now, this Christian Reformed Church, if you do not know, has a very robust theology on the depravity of all mankind. And the CRC has a very robust theology that says we are saved not by works, but by faith. So, in the prayer time, before we discussed this document, I reminded the Synod in my prayer that we have these beliefs in a hope that we might create a space, a theological space, to deal with our systemic corporate sin. And they threw it out the window. And justified themselves before each other through their works. Why? If you murder somebody, if you rob somebody, if you commit adultery with somebody, and you go to the church and say, "I've done this action, I've committed this sin, I need some help," the church will come to you and say, "You're in luck. We know this guy Jesus. He died on a cross. He shed his blood for your sin. You may have to have some challenges because of your sin, but you can be forgiven and you can still have life." And they are not lying. But if you go to the church and you say, "I want to wrestle with the sin of slavery. I want to wrestle with the sin of genocide. I want to wrestle with the sin of stolen lands and broken treaties and internment camps and children separated from their families at our borders. I want to wrestle with this." And you go to the church, and the church will look at you dumbfounded and then will say, "Can I wash your feet?" Why? Why does the church have no theological space to wrestle with systemic corporate sin? Well, let's go back to the Old Testament. So in the Old Testament, The people of Israel had a land covenant with the God of Abraham. This land covenant set up their prosperity as a barometer of their relationship with God. When they were obedient to God, he blessed them and they flourished on their land. When they were disobedient, he cursed them and they were removed from their land. So they could tell generally how they were doing with God based on their prosperity. Their prosperity was one of their barometers of their relationship with God. Now, when Jesus came, the people of Israel were under the oppression of the Romans. They were not able to worship freely. They were being taxed. They were having census taken. They were not able to move about freely. And they knew something was out of sorts. This is why the Pharisees rose up, and they thought maybe as lay people, if we live as the priests live under this priestly law, God might have mercy upon us and send his Messiah sooner to set us free from our oppressors. And so Jesus came into this environment. He knew the people of Israel were looking for an imperial political Messiah. And he knew that's not what he came to do. So while he was the Son of God, he was born in a barn. While angels announced his singing, they were singing to shepherds. While he was indeed a Messiah, he grew up as a refugee in Egypt. He was trying to communicate, I have different goals and expectations than what you have. When Satan came to tempt him, he came and brought Jesus to a high hill and showed him the kingdoms of the world and said, if you bow down and worship me, I will give you what he thought was the goal, which is the kingdoms of the world. And Jesus scoffed at him and walked away. When he fed 4,000 people with someone's Lunchable, and they were so excited, they came to make him king by force, he walked away. Right? When he was with James and John and they went into a Samaritan village and they were rejected by the village and they're walking out of the village and James and John say, can we be the ones to call down fire from heaven and destroy them? Now, their request is not that outlandish. In the Old Testament, when you disobey the people, God sends you a prophet. If you heed the words of the prophet, he has mercy on you. If you reject the prophet, it's fire and brimstone from heaven. This is Jericho. This is Sodom and Gomorrah. Elijah twice called down fire from heaven upon people. Three times, actually, including on the prophets of Baal. So this is what happens. So James and John aren't asking, should we call down? They assume they should. They said, can we be the ones? We want to be like Elijah. We want to be this great prophet. Jesus says, no, that's not what you do. Then he sends him out to another Samaritan village. Now, in Mark chapter 8, Jesus says to his disciples, who do the people think I am? Some say, well, they think you're the Messiah. Some think you're John the Baptist. Some think you're one of the prophets. Some think you're Elijah. Jesus says, well, who do you think I am? Peter says, you're the Messiah. Now, if the only goal is to teach him that he's the Messiah, Jesus is done. He's accomplished his work. But he tells them, surprisingly, shh, don't say anybody. Don't say anything. Why? They didn't understand what the role of the Messiah was. Even John the Baptist, right? He's in prison. He hears Jesus is out teaching and healing. He hears Jesus has healed the servant of a centurion. Right? This is the oppressor. These are the people who are unjustly oppressing the people of Israel. This is a man in charge of 100 other men. John the Baptist is probably being guarded by a centurion while he's in prison. And he hears Jesus has healed one of their servants. And he's so dumbfounded, he sends his disciples to Jesus to say, are you the one who's coming or should we expect somebody else? This is not what the Messiah is supposed to do, Jesus. Jesus turns around, he heals more sick people, casts out more demons, gives sight to more of the blind, hearing to more of the deaf, and tells his disciples, go back and tell your master what you saw, and blessed is the man who doesn't fall away on my account. This is what I'm doing, John. Get on board or get out of the way. So Jesus tells his disciples that the Son of Man must suffer and die. He must be persecuted. In the Beatitudes, he says, when you are persecuted, you should rejoice. because this is how they treated the prophets of old. So Jesus is giving the disciples a new barometer. They will know they are doing well in their discipleship, not when they prosper, not when they are well fed, not when others think well of them. They will know they are doing well in their discipleship when they are persecuted because of the words of Jesus. Now, the disciples didn't like this barometer. They rejected it. In fact, Peter was so shocked that he pulled his own teacher aside and started to rebuke him. And Jesus called him Satan. The disciples, the rest of the book of Mark, chapter 8 through 16, is Jesus battling with his disciples about this new barometer. They do not want to accept this barometer, and it's not until the book of Acts, when Pentecost happens, that the disciples finally get it, and most of them go on, starting with Stephen, to die a martyr's death. Now, in the early church, the first through the third centuries, when you join the church through your baptism, your confession, your discipleship, and your community, you know that you are joining a group of people who are standing in opposition to institutionalized religion and to the empire. You know there's a good chance you're going to be persecuted and even maybe even die because of your membership in this church. Now, in the fourth century, Eusebius, who is the bishop of Caesarea, the person who baptized Constantine, he sets out to accomplish a monumental task, which is to write an ecclesiastical history. The church is fairly new. It hasn't been well organized. There's not a good record of the life of the church. And so he sets out to write an ecclesiastical history, a history of the church. He begins with the babies killed at Jesus' birth, picks up again at Stephen, and goes through three centuries of persecution and martyrdom. And he identifies the martyrs as dying with joy because they were sharing in the suffering of Christ. Mm-hmm. Now, ecclesiastical history is a volume of 11 books. And in book 8, he introduces Constantius, who is the father of Constantine, as a blessed and good emperor, which is confounding because the whole book up to this point is about the persecution of the Christians by the emperors of Rome. And then he introduces Constantine as an emperor blessed by God for such a time as this. Which again is confusing. Because up until now, the emperors of Rome have been horrible for the church. Well, between books 8 and 9, there's inserted a book called the Book of the Martyrs. 13 chapters of martyrs from the great persecution in 303 AD. This happened in Caesarea and in Palestine, where Eusebius was from. He identifies he knew most of these martyrs himself, and he saw many of them of their deaths personally. And it's book 8 where his attitude towards martyrdom begins changing. In book 8, he gives an account of the battle at Melvain Bridge, which is where Constantine supposedly had his vision of God. But he doesn't tell the vision in this book. But he instead compares Constantine to Moses defeating Pharaoh at the Red Sea. And then in book 9, 10 and 11, he begins propping up the emperors. Now, if you're writing a book called Ecclesiastical History, and you understand who Jesus is and what his message was, your book doesn't have an ending, correct? Because when will the history of the church end? When the bridegroom returns, right? You're merely writing a chapter, the beginning of an ongoing saga that will continue until the Son of Man returns. So your book, if you have any sense of who you are and what you're writing about, your book called Ecclesiastical History will not have an ending or a conclusion. But if you read Constantine's book, Ecclesiastical History, you will note that he absolutely has a conclusion. The last chapter is called The Victory of Constantine and the Blessings Under Him Accrued to the Whole Roman World. They celebrated splendid and festive days with joy and hilarity. All things were filled with light, and all who were before him were sunk in sorrow, beheld each other with smiling and cheerful faces. At the same time, they celebrated and extolled, first of all, God, the universal King. Then thus they were taught. They also celebrated the praises of not Christ, but the pious emperor. and with him all his divinely favored children. There was a perfect oblivion of past evils, and past wickedness was buried in forgetfulness. There was nothing but enjoyment of the present, blessings and expectations of those yet to come. The supreme God granted from heaven above the fruits of his piety, the trophies of victory over the wicked, and that Narcissus tyrant with all his counselors and adherents, he cast prostrate, not at the feet of Christ, but at the feet of Constantine. So, ecclesiastical history, according to Eusebius, absolutely has a conclusion. And the conclusion is the salvation that comes to Rome, not through Christ, but through Constantine. See, when the great persecution touched Eusebius, he decided he didn't like this new barometer, and he wanted to go back to the barometer of prosperity. And so he propped up the most likely emperor who could end the persecution, and he taught him a heresy of Christian empire, and said, "You can be God's ruler here on earth." Constantine bit, and he Christianized Rome. And Eusebius then had to document this, because if you're going to have a heresy of Christendom, which Christ was absolutely opposed to, the first thing you have to do, because Christ and Christian empire are oppositely opposed, the first thing you have to do is you have to write Christ out of ecclesiastical history, which is exactly what Eusebius did. Which is why his book does not conclude with the salvation that comes through Christ, but the salvation that comes through Constantine.
That's an interesting interpretation.
His next book, The Life of the Blessed Constantine, chapter 4 is how God honored Constantine. Chapter 6 was how he was the servant of God and the conqueror of nations. Chapter 8, now what did Satan promise Christ if he would bow down to him on top of the hill?
The whole world.
He received the submission of all rulers and governors and satraps and barbarous nations, who cheerfully welcomed and saluted him. Constantine alone of all emperors was acknowledged and celebrated by all. Chapter 13 was while he was praying, or 18, God sent him a vision of a light in the heavens at midday with an inscription admonishing him to conquer by that.
So, where does the patriarch come in on this? The patriarchs and the double-headed eagle and the balance between church and state and the Byzantine Empire.
We're not there yet. Chapter 19 was how when Christ appeared to him in his sleep, he commanded him to use in his wars a standard made in the form of a cross. Now we have another father of the church who received a vision from Christ after he died, and that was Saul. Right? He was traveling to Damascus to persecute the church, and Christ appeared to him and blinded him and sent him stumbling into Damascus. He let him sit there for 3 days. And after 3 days, he sent Ananias to him. And his message from Ananias was, tell Saul how much he must suffer on account of my name. Now, he wasn't punishing Saul. He was telling Saul what the new barometer is. Because when you follow Christ, your discipleship will be gauged not by your prosperity, but by your persecution. I don't know who Constantine saw a vision of. I guarantee you it was not Christ. Christ would not appear to the most powerful emperor in the world and tell him to destroy his enemies and conquer under the symbol of a cross. So in the 5th century, the theologians have a challenge, which is, do they collude with this heresy, or do they prophesy to it? Augustine writes a just war theory. The purpose of the just war theory is really twofold: to help wars be fought more justly, and to justify how Christian citizens of a Christian empire can now go off and kill in the name of God and country, which, according to the teaching of Jesus, is a challenge theologically. So I use the fact that there is a just war theory as the fact that the theologians decided to collude with the Christian empire instead of challenge it. But I was looking for where we went off the rails. Where did we misstep? In his book, The Correction of the Donatists, Augustine is essentially asking, what's the role of a Christian king in the Christian empire? He concludes that his role is to prevent and chastise with religious severity all those acts which are done in opposition to the commands of the Lord. For a man serves God in one way, that he is man, another way, he is a king. In that he is man, he serves him by living faithfully, but in that he is king, he serves him by enforcing with suitable rigor such laws as ordain what is righteous and punishes what is the reverse. In the next chapter, he says it's better that men should worship God by teaching than be driven to it by fear of punishment or pain. But many have found advantage in being first compelled by fear or pain so that later they might respond to sound teaching. So he's arguing the role of the Christian king in the Christian empire is to use fear, punishment, and pain to compel people to worship God. Clearly, this is outside the teachings of Jesus. This leads into the experience of the Crusades, which is about protecting Jerusalem and expanding the Christian empire. In the 13th century, we have Thomas Aquinas writing, and he's also dealing with the heretics. And he is asking, what do we do with the heretics? And he concludes it's a much graver matter to corrupt the faith, which quickens the soul, than to forge money, which supports temporal right. Wherefore, if forgers of money and other evildoers are forthwith condemned to death by the secular authority, how much more reason there for heretics, as soon as they are convicted of heresy, to not only be excommunicated, but even put to death. So he's arguing the role of the Christian king in the Christian empire is to kill people who don't obey the commands of God. In the 13th century, the church introduces the word infidels, which is a category of others, supplied to the Moors, who are the Muslims, and later the indigenous peoples. Now that we have this subhuman category of infidels, we don't even need a just war theory. Now we can go to war on our theological grounds. We're fighting the other, the enemies of Christ. And so in 1452, Pope Nicholas V writes out these words, invade, search out, capture, vanquish, and subdue all Saracens and pagans whatsoever. Reduce their persons to perpetual slavery. Convert them to his and to their use and profit. This papal bull, along with other papal bulls between 1452 and 1493, are collectively known as what we call the doctrine of discovery. This is a doctrine. It's essentially the church in Europe saying to the nations of Europe, wherever you go, whatever lands you find not ruled by white European Christian rulers, those people are subhuman and their land is yours for the taking. This is literally the doctrine that the European nations go into Africa, colonize the continent and enslave the people. It also is what allowed Columbus, who was lost at sea, to land in this new world and claim to have discovered it. You cannot discover lands already inhabited. It's called stealing, conquering, colonizing. The fact that to this day we call what he did discovery reveals the implicit racial bias of the nation, which is that indigenous peoples, people of color, are not fully human. This makes the doctrine of discovery a white, male, Christian supremacist doctrine that's the fruit of a church that has prostituted itself out to the empire.
Oh, brother, these are hard words.
Now, in 1630, initially the Protestant church pushed back against the doctrine of discovery. This was a Catholic doctrine. They didn't buy into it. 1630, John Winthrop is in the Boston Harbor preaching to a group of colonists, a sermon called The Model of Christian Charity. In his sermon, he compares them to a city on a hill. He's borrowing from the language of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. Be a lamp on a stand, a city on a hill, shining your good deeds into the dark world. He exhorts them in all meekness, gentleness, patience, and morality. Rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together. Keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. End of his sermon, he begins quoting from Deuteronomy chapter 30 to try to convince the people to obey his teachings. Now, Deuteronomy 30 is the passage in the Old Testament where the people of Israel are standing at the banks of the Jordan River, ready to cross over and take possession of their promised lands, and God reiterating the threats and promises of his land covenant. If you obey me, I'll do these things to you. If you disobey me, I'll do these things to you. End of this passage, it says, but if our hearts shall turn away so that we will not obey, and we worship other gods, we will surely perish out of the good land, whether we pass over this river to possess it. Now, Deuteronomy 30 says river, but in his sermon, John Winthrop says vast sea. Why would he say vast sea? They crossed the ocean, not a river. Mm-hmm. So what's he implying? Based on the teachings of Jesus, based on the model of Old Testament Israel and promised lands, we are standing on the banks of our promised lands, ready to go and take possession of them. Now, if you read the books of Joshua and Deuteronomy, what is the commands for the people of Israel to do to the people in their promised lands?
Kill.
Kill everybody.
Yep.
Do not leave anything alive that breathes. This is the birth of American exceptionalism. 100 years later, we begin expanding westward, go past the Mississippi River, past the Appalachian Mountains. End of the 1700s, we have the Second Great Awakening. It's a growth in churches, a renewal of denominations. Early 1830s and 40s, we have the term manifest destiny being coined. The notion that this nation is God's chosen people and has his right to rule these lands from sea to shining sea. In 1851, the first governor of California, in his first State of the State address, this is what he said: that a war of extermination will continue to be waged between the races until the Indian race becomes extinct must be expected. While we cannot anticipate this result, but with painful regret, the inevitable destiny of the race is beyond the power or wisdom of man to avert. He's not saying there's a famine and it's not raining and we can't feed them. And he's not saying there's a virus or disease that broke out and we can't stop him. He is saying we cannot stop killing these people, because that is what you do when you have promised lands. And that is what you do when you have a manifest destiny. In March 3rd, 2015, Benjamin Netanyahu was speaking to a joint session of Congress. Congress was very divided, very partisan. He had to get everyone on the same page behind him. So early in his speech, he chose one of the most unifying topics in American politics, which is American exceptionalism. And he said to our Congress, because America and Israel, we share a common destiny, the destiny of promised lands. After a terrorist attack in 2017, Clay Higgins, a representative from Louisiana's 3rd District, identifies himself on his website as a Christian who is known for his refreshing power of the focus of the individual to be redeemed. On the day of a terrorist attack in London, this is what he wrote on his public Facebook page: "The free world, all of Christendom, is at war with Islamic horror. Not one penny of American treasure should be granted to any nation who harbors these heathen animals. Not a single radicalized Islamic suspect should be granted any measure of quarter. Their intended entry to the American homeland should be summarily denied. Every conceivable measure should be engaged to hunt them down, hunt them, identify them, and kill them all. For the sake of all that's good and righteous, kill them all." Clay Higgins, U.S. Congress, Louisiana's 3rd District, June 4th, 2017. And Facebook didn't even take this down as hate speech. This, my brothers and sisters, is why our churches don't know how to deal with race.
Come on.
This is why we can offer Christ for individual sin, but when it comes to systemic corporate sin, we have no other better solutions than to wash your feet. It's because we have written Christ out of ecclesiastical history and inserted Constantine. And this is what makes the church, by and large, today impotent in regards to race.
So really, there's 4 complicated emotions you got to disciple people through when you deal with this stuff. It's anger, grief, shame, and fear. And as a person, like as white people, there's an amount of shame you'll deal with, but then also people of color. Like, if you're indigenous or you're African and you hear this story, you're like, don't nobody like this story. That's a shame that comes out of that, you know, but at least you've been walking around the shame and not being able to articulate it. At least being able to name it takes the power away. And then you could be like, oh, I can do something. I can like work outside of this in this particular space. And so this stuff is like really, really key. I thought that we would lose a ton of people starting to do. I mean, I think there's a way that you can go about, like my wife could tell me hard truths, but it's just like how she says it. It's just as important as not what she says, you know what I mean? So I think, but the reason why she could do that is because we're committed to each other.
Yeah.
So like, if you're gonna really be committed, and if you're not gonna like walk away when it gets super hard, then you can work through this stuff, and it's a matter of how you do it.
So the thing I wanted to say is, just like Jesus was not afraid to call out Peter, and he still became the cornerstone of the church.
Yeah.
We have saints, we have people we look up to in the history of the church. What I just want to encourage you in is we can't be afraid to call them out. We can't be afraid to say, no, this teaching was wrong. That doesn't mean reject everything Augustine wrote or everything Constantine wrote, but we have to be able to point out where it went wrong and then say, yeah, can we grow and learn from that? Obviously. But we tend to either saint everything or condemn everything. And we have to be able to look at it through the lens of Christ and say, we can work with this teaching. We cannot work with this teaching.
Yeah.
And we have to be able to call that out.